You're listening to Heartland. I'm Kyle Isham.
And I'm Rachel Otwell. Today on the program, we speak with two artists. One, an American refugee, now living in San Diego, California. She uses music, poetry, art, and performance as peacemaking tools while forging meaningful connections with those who are different than herself. Later, we'll hear from Amanda Grieve. She lives on a farm with her husband and young daughter out in rural Edinburgh, Illinois. We talk about her artwork, which often features solitary women and elements from nature. She tells us, for her, art is a form of spirituality. First,
now we're joined by Ari Hanovar. She is the founder of Rumi with a View, which combines translations of Rumi's poetry, performance, and visual art. We'll talk to her about that later. Also, she grew up in Iran during the Iranian war with Iraq. Lately, she's been in the news for her writings on being a refugee from one of the 7 countries originally included in the Trump administration's travel ban. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ari.
Thank you for having me.
Your recent writing is called I'm a Refugee from a Banned Country. This is my American story. Will you tell us the basis of what you wanted to share with people and what prompted you and why?
The whole reason behind the Trump ban that has been explained to the public is that it's going to make America safer by banning refugees from these 7 countries. And there is really no evidence to support this claim at all. And refugees themselves go through a very heavy vetting process before they are allowed in the U.S. My reason for publishing this article was to humanize refugees and also tell my story, my love for America and my love for Iran and what happened to me as an individual, as a child refugee, when I migrated from Iran to America.
And in this article, you talk some about what was happening in Iran immediately after the revolution. Could you talk a little bit about some of the parallels and similarities that maybe are alarming you between the current administration in the U.S. and what you saw growing up during the post-revolution years?
Yeah, so in Iran, it took only a matter of months to cut women's rights, jail journalists, target people of a certain religion, become involved in a deadly war, and label dissidents as terrorists. The Iranian government cited security to trump freedom and rights, and its supporters followed along without questioning the new laws. So there is a certain parallel here, and I believe that our American democratic ideals and rights guaranteed by the Constitution are being undermined right now, and we have a responsibility to challenge that.
And as a follow-up to that, what in the public's response in the U.S. currently gives you hope that this can be countered?
Well, I love this quote by Rumi that he says, if you don't like what you see in the mirror, break yourself and not the mirror. And that is what's so encouraging about what's happening right now. Whether we like it or not, this current administration is a reflection of aspects of America that have been hidden or have gone unchallenged for eons. And now we have a chance to really examine ourselves through these extreme circumstances and see how we can, as a society, live up to our democratic ideals. People are more engaged and more motivated than I've ever seen. They're resourceful, they're creative and determined. So it's a very exciting time in that regard.
So you also recently met with a woman from Iraq who is working with Syrian refugees. You two obviously grew up with different views on the Iraq-Iran war. What was it like connecting with her?
It was like meeting an old friend, actually. She and I had many similarities, even though we were stuck on the opposite sides of the Iran-Iraq war as children. We both had to go hide in our basements and worry about the missiles and the bombs. And we both saw the other as the enemy at the time. But, you know, after we moved here, or maybe even then, there was really no animosity between the people themselves. You know, if we understood there is a recognition that people are people, and what atrocities happen, we can get beyond it by just meeting one another and form relationships and do something positive together.
And I noticed that one insight you shared regarding your meeting is that you said music is the most immediate icebreaker, and you're part of an effort called Musical Ambassadors of Peace, which aims to help build musical and poetic bridges across war-torn borders. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this group, the Musical Ambassadors of Peace, they actually went to Iraq right after the invasion, and they were armed with an oud and singers singing Iraqi love songs in the streets, and people just couldn't believe it. They said, oh my God, you're an American, you're Americans, you didn't bring weapons, you're not contractors, you're just bringing your music and love our culture. So that was very inspiring, and I joined the group. We performed in Colorado together, and it was very well received by the audience. Part of what I do with other musicians is that when the anti-Muslim and anti-refugee sentiments began spreading last year or so, I collaborated with musicians and recited Rumi poetry in Farsi and English, and telling stories about my life as a refugee, as living in a country in the midst of a war, Rumi's life as a child refugee himself, and basically educating an audience by presenting a Middle East that's rooted in inclusiveness, kindness, and celebration. And that's not really a typical impression that an average American has of Middle East.
And given the current kind of polarized political sphere that the United States is in currently, how do we find the common human ground between people we not only agree with, but those who seem to be in great opposition towards our ideals?
Well, I have a firm belief that it's not only nice to find common ground, but I believe it's our democratic responsibility to do so. Again, mirroring nature, we live in a diverse realm, and believe it or not, that's our strength, to have different points of views, perspectives, and chemistry. Our aim shouldn't really be to change everybody's mind. It shouldn't even be to change a single person's mind. What we really have going for us is developing functional relationships, a functional relationship with another person whom we don't agree with. We have to see their humanity and see that they deserve to live in a safe and sane society, and maybe help them see our own humanity and how we also deserve to live in a safe and sane world.
And what do you see as the bigger obstacles facing us spiritually as a culture?
I think individual salvation is the biggest hindrance to our spiritual evolution. Of course, don't get me wrong, it's quite an achievement that, especially in the past century, many people have become more self-reflective and concerned about self-care. But there can be a subtle misunderstanding that, hey, if I'm happy, then all is well. The thing we call happiness becomes this elusive mirage that keeps us chasing after it to infinitum, while we neglect our neighbors, our environment, even our own immediate families. So luckily, we can do better to be in this world fully. We have to be engaged and nourish the inner landscape and care about our outer world. Both are equally important.
That was Ari Hanavar, an artist and Iranian-American living in California. We talked to her about her recent writings and work to build bridges and community through face-to-face interactions.
For more on Ari's work, head to IllinoisEdition.org and look for the latest Heartland post. You're listening to Illinois Edition and Heartland. We're joined now by an award-winning artist who lives in Edinburgh, Illinois, about 20 minutes outside of Springfield. She showed us her studio, a converted dining room in the old farmhouse she lives in. Amanda Grieve tells us about her artwork, which is mainly of females and is realistic yet also incorporates contemporary and past symbolism that explores the human condition.
The pieces that I'm working on right now, I call my flower face paintings. And for the most part, they are, you know, women who are either in the act of consoling one another or they are daily ritual of getting ready, you know, putting on their face for the world. And so all of these women have different arrangements of flowers that cover their face. And for me, that is just a nod to this idea that women have to make themselves pretty, that they have to put on a fresh face every morning, that they are expected to look a certain way to present themselves to the world.
What was your religious or spiritual background growing up?
I was brought up Catholic, so I went to a Catholic grade school and went through confirmation in high school and went to the religion classes in high school and all that. So long story short, I was brought up Catholic.
And so how has it developed and changed as you've gotten older?
Now I'm not sure that I know that I wouldn't consider myself a very religious person, but I would say that I do consider myself a spiritual person. When you're younger, you don't question things. But as I got older and, you know, frankly, as I became more aware of like certain scandals that were happening in the Catholic Church, that did make me question my faith. The other part of me that made me question my religion was how women weren't allowed to be priests. They weren't given really active roles in the Catholic Church, and I could never understand why that was the case.
How has living out in the country influenced your work and the process of its creation?
I would think probably the biggest influence is just the quiet. You know, there's no distraction out here. It's usually just the sounds of nature or, you know, the occasional tractor, I guess. Being isolated in that sense, physically anyway, is very soothing and allows for a more conducive environment for creating and for just having time to think about or daydream about the things that you want to create. Living in the country and having at times lived in the city, living in the country is definitely more conducive to my creative thought process.
So before, when we were talking, you mentioned the sort of what you call everyday feminism, or maybe feminism that's a little more subversive. So describe for people how that plays out in the work.
I would definitely say that my work has a feminist bent. But, you know, I think, too, it's been my experience that whenever you mention feminism or the F word, people kind of either glaze over or they not so much get angry, but maybe become a little defensive. So I feel like my work is what I call everyday feminism, where it's a softer form of feminism. And I portray it that way because I feel like knowing myself, I don't want people to yell at me or to make me force something down my throat that they think is right. I am the type of person, I think a lot of people are this way, it's easier if you come to a certain idea of your own volition with gentle guidance. And so I feel like my paintings are that way. I feel like they convey a feminism, but it's a feminism that is softer and maybe forces you to ask questions yourself and maybe delve into this subject or become more interested in the idea of feminism.
And you mentioned, like, for instance, one of these paintings is done on a tabletop. Can you talk about the choice there?
Having the tabletops was a deliberate choice because tables are present in our kitchens, and kitchens are a decidedly, you know, feminine domicile. So there was a decision to include those as part of the painting because it was a decidedly feminine thing.
How does painting, or when you're in that process, act as a spiritual practice for you? Or what are you connecting to in those moments?
There's an element of ritual. You have the things that you always do. You always gesso the canvas a certain amount of times. The way you prep the composition, or, you know, even just mixing the paints, for me is a very therapeutic thing. It's very, you know, you go in there and that's my quiet space. Especially in like these very tumultuous times, you know, it's nice to have a space where you can go and you can sit there and I can get my colors. I can get my phthalo green and my alizarin crimson, and I can mix those together, and I know what they're going to be, and I know how they're going to look on the canvas. But even just getting lost in the act of it, putting brush to a board and having it morph into this thing that you know you can do, but when you look back at it, you think, gosh, I did that, you know, that this is something that I created, and yes, you were there the whole time, you're making it, you're watching it happen, but you still look back and you think, I don't even know how I did that. I'm just, there must be some like higher hand in being able to make something that way.
When you feel that connection to something higher, is that something you attribute as being internal, external, or do they kind of blend together?
Kind of blends together. You know, there are times when I swear that I can, and maybe I shouldn't even be saying this because it sounds really silly, but like as I'm putting the brush to the board, I can see where the line is before it goes. And so it's kind of like this weird, like somebody's telling you that it should go this way, or, you know, this is the way that it should look. But, you know, the other part of that is just being very instinctual and getting to know like an object or a person on a very intimate level. There are people that I've painted so many times that I don't even have to look at them. I could probably, or a picture of them, I could just paint them from memory. And so there's that very internal part of it also.
One thing Amanda Grieve talked about was the impact literature has had on her artwork. We noted a big pile of books in her studio, including poetry by Pablo Neruda and the novel Go Set a Watchman by Harper Lee.
If I were to ever show you my notebooks, you know, they aren't sketches. They are passages from books or from songs that I find relevant to my work or that in some way inspire me. Those books are just a portion of the things that I read, but I read a lot of science fiction, I read a lot of feminist books, and so yeah, everything I read at some point plays into my work.
For more information and to see examples of Amanda Grieve's artwork, head to IllinoisEdition.org and look for this Heartland post.
That's it for today's episode of Heartland. I'm Rachel Otwell.
And I'm Kyle Isham.